I'm talking to Mary Bennett in 25A Alma Place on the 1st of February 1994.
That's right.
That's right. And we're in the dining room and we're sitting across a cup of tea. And you were just saying that you think Isaiah looks much more like his father now than he did when he was young. And I wonder what you meant by that. I mean, you said more than look, he's come to resemble.
More like, yes, it's not so much looks. It's, it's a more staid impression,
yes.
I suppose.
Yes.
And in a sense, more establishmental.
Yes. And that was what his father was like in some sense.
Yes. He was the sweetest of men, but he hadn't got the zip of Mrs. Berlin.
Yes. I'd like to talk to you systematically about the parents, but I think what I'd like to do also is to get a chronology of how you came to know Isaiah and when you came to know him first, and really concentrate very heavily on the period of the 30s. I'm just wondering whether you can remember when you first... when you first met him, but when you first heard of him, when he first kind of loomed into your ken.
No, I can't remember. I think probably the first definite impression, when did he become a lecturer of New College?
32? September 32?
Yes. Well, I think I'd probably just met him before then and probably had heard of him a bit through the Lynn sisters, Sheila and Moira,
yes.
Sheila and BJ. And their friends. But the first definite impression I think I had of him is when my father came in after interviewing him for the lectureship, saying that at last here was a young man like the young men of his generation who were interested in everything.
Of course, Isaiah, when he came to New College Common Room in September 32, thought it was death.
Yes, I know. Well,
and perhaps your father did too.
Perhaps my father did too.
When did you first actually set eyes on him?
Can't remember.
Well, when you think back to him as a very young man, we're talking 32. What kind of physical impression do you have? What comes into your mind?
Frightfully ugly.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, notably ugly.
Yes. Yeah. The nose, the ears, the complexion. What is it that makes him so ugly? The curly hair, the what? The whole deportment?
I can't say. I can't pin it down to one thing.
Yeah.
Just the general visual experience.
Yeah. But then despite that, you become fond of him.
Yes.
That's rather odd, though, isn't it?
Oh, surely not, is it?
Right.
And everybody was fond of him. Nobody could not be.
Yeah.
I first knew him well, got to know him well, I can date you that quite accurately. When he and Christopher Cox and Moira Lind, BJ and I, all went to Ireland together.
That's
33, I think.
Yes. What do you recall of that trip to Ireland?
Almost everything. You've seen the piece he wrote about the visit to Bowen's Court and Elizabeth Bowen.
Yes.
I was the youngest of that quartet, and very much the elite grown up. And I didn't really know any of them at all well, and I was therefore very much, in a sense, a passenger of the elders. And I can't remember who it was who said we ought to go, we must go and call on Elizabeth Bowen at Bowen's Court. I hadn't ever met her. But anyhow, it seemed to me a sort of faintly embarrassing call, because I don't think we let her know beforehand we were descending on her. And we arrived to find her and her companion, whom we all thought was called Miss Prong, but who turned out to be called Miss Brown, I believe, sitting in what seemed to us, it seemed to me anyhow, because we were all rather windblown in an open car, exquisite silk summer dresses, topping and tailing gooseberries on the perron of Bowen's Court. And I should think I probably hardly opened my lips on that curious 24 hours, because I felt very much the youngest and the least in the world. And, well, the party has been described by Isaiah in that piece. Extraordinary Irish mixture of delicious salmon and very nasty other food, I can't remember what it was, and coffee after dinner strengthened with tea.
No.
Yes.
Oh, really?
And I committed the most frightful social gaffe, because we were all having cups of coffee after dinner, and I couldn't think why it tasted so nasty. I mean, it really tasted quite exceptional awful. And lo and behold, there were tea leaves in the coffee cup.
Really? And by error.
Not by
this
error.
By
it had been put in the kitchen to make the coffee stronger as it emerged. Go and fill up the cup. I don't think I was fully aware of the currents of agitation that were apparently going through Isaiah over B.J. capturing Humphrey House.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me perfectly familiar. B.J. captured every young man who was irresistible. So beautiful.
When did you find out that it was agitating Isaiah?
I don't know that I ever did, really. I expect the agitation is slightly written up in that piece.
Yes.
I should have thought it probably agitated Christopher Cox, who regarded himself as much older than the rest of us, and regarded himself as a sort of chaperone, rather more. Well, then, having shed Humphrey House, we ran into a donkey cart. I'm not sure that this is this recorded in Isaiah's piece, perhaps. I was driving, and we took it, BJ and Christopher and I took it in turns to drive, and I drove the car, mercifully not very fast, slap into the back of a donkey cart that I hadn't seen in a patch of dapple.
In a patch of what?
Dapple, of dappled light.
Light, yes.
Mm.
Yes.
And the first thing I was conscious of was BJ saying we must catch the donkey, and Christopher's hand dripping with blood because a little bit of finger come off with flying glass, and an old lady in the hedge moaning, saying she was killed. Then two, I can't think how all this happened, but some charming civic guards turned up. And I've no doubt BJ's appealingness got round them, because they said they were sure it was quite an accident, and we heard no more, and got back to Galway, where Christopher went into hospital and the other three of us spent a night in an hotel. And the next morning, a splendid Irish countess called the Countess Metaxa, who's son-in-law, I think, or perhaps daughter-in-law, was a friend of Christopher's, came with son-in-law came with her son to Christopher's bedside in hospital and offered us the loan of her island to recuperate in. And so we all went off to it, and we all were quite divinely happy there. It was a sort of Elysian period. Mm-hmm. We don't have any of these things.
Where was that island? I've heard the story of the accident, but I'm not quite clear what
the island was in
is.
In a lake at a place called Malm Cross, near a place called Malm Cross.
What made it so happy?
I don't know. We all got on. We were all very carefree. It was very, very beautiful. And it was very serene. It was a very serene place.
Can you remember what you talked about?
No. I never can remember what I talked about. It was the most elusive. I think we talked a good deal about, I imagine we talked a good deal about the management of life. I mean, whether we were going to shore to buy potatoes or who was going to bathe. You know, that sort of conversation.
Yeah.
We laughed a great deal. Isaiah made pancakes.
Did he?
He did.
One who's never ceased, is all I can say. Did you have a sense of, with him, of kind of non-stop volubility? Or did he sort of relax?
He relaxed. He spent quite a lot of time reading a book. While he was much less active than the rest of us. The rest of us were all three the sort of people who walked up mountains and swam. Mm-hmm. And while we did this, he peacefully read his book. No, it was all extremely unscrewing.
Can I back you up a bit and ask how you, the junior partner, would have ended up on this summer holiday in 33? How did you end up in the foursome at all? What had happened? What made it come together?
I suppose that for the first time I felt that I knew well as a result of all living in the same house and having gone through the experience of the accident.
Mm-hmm.
Two interesting and congenial men, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Who were, from then on, both of them close friends.
Of what Isaiah was like in 32, 33. I'll tell you what almost my biggest difficulty as a biographer is to get a sense of change over time with him, because there is a sort of line that you hear about Isaiah that he's always essentially been the same in a way.
Mm.
I have a sense that there's another persona, an earlier persona on display in the 30s. I'm trying to put my finger on it. And some people say he's much more of an aesthete then, much more dandified, much more sort of elaborate, sort of Jamesian persona created here.
I shouldn't have said that. I didn't see that bit of him.
I think I'm on the edge of saying he could be slightly affected to cover his insecurities.
Well, I expect that may be so, but of course if one has all been living at a rather primitive level making pancakes, this is not the side that emerges.
Yes.
I mean, we were all very ungrown up.
Yes.
I mean, our collective life was camping out, so to speak, at rather more than... I would have said... My experience of my recollection of the young Isaiah was a complete absence of any put-onness.
Mm-hmm. come with him. You felt cozy.
Absolutely,
with him.
Absolutely, yes. Like as if we'd known each other all our lives, that sort of relationship.
Does that strike you as slightly, doesn't that strike you as slightly odd in a way, or it strikes me as slightly odd? Here you are, a sort of grand lady in a way, or from a grand family, and here's this kind of Russian Jew suddenly arrives in Oxford, and you hit it off. I mean, you're from very different worlds, is what I'm getting at. And does it puzzle you in retrospect that you did get on so well, or that he seemed to swim so easily in that milieu?
I didn't find it in the least puzzling at the time. It seemed the most natural sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I felt he was, in a sense, a foreigner. But it didn't make any difference to the sort of coziness, as you might say. More tea? Can I fill you up?
You could. So when you, unless you have any further memories of that. Summer of 33.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how your, whether you can describe what going to see him and what your contact with him was like after that in, say, 33, 34. And go to see him in his rooms. Go to
I used to go and have tea with him from time to time. Then he used to have lunch parties, like as young dons did then. And I was, it was a sort of general part of my growing up, because I, at that sort of age, met a lot of other people too, and went about and went out to lunch and dinner and so on. Which I hadn't very much before. Whereas the BJ and her Paulina friends, like Sheila Grant Duff and Diana Hopkinson, had all lived a very social life before they came up to Oxford and carried on with it and were very much in a swim with all the Crossman, Goronwy Rees, Adam von Trott, and to some extent, I suppose, Maurice Pyra. I very much wasn't. And I didn't really start swimming, as we might say, until after that summer of 33.
Create a sense of the circle of his friends and acquaintances at that time, 33, 34, particularly the circle of women friends. I'm just wondering how you would name the pattern, get the people lined up.
34.
I'm not going to hold you to the dates, that's all.
Or thereabouts. I don't think I can say anything about it, really. I don't think I haven't got any very clear picture of it.
When, I think one of the things that Isaiah has talked about quite a lot to me is just his relationship with Tipps Walker. I was wondering when you have a sense of that beginning. And
he has talked to you about all that, has he?
Yes, he has.
You probably know more in a sense than I have. I do, I mean, well, because really she went absolutely completely off her head. I don't know when it began. I think they met, through me and at the lodgings, probably. And you, he will have given you a picture of her and her extreme brilliance and fascination. And everybody of both sexes found her quite unlike anyone else and fascinating in the highest degree. What their relationship, what point their relationship had got reached before she went to France, which she did in the year 34-35, I don't feel sure. Because although I knew her well, in the sense that she was my closest friend at that time, of course people don't tell you the truth about their private lives, do they? Well, up to a point, but only not up to a point, but not beyond it, so to speak. Now, when she was in France, she was fallen in love with by a man called Cavaillès at the École Normale, who was a very heroic and simple character who was ultimately shot by the Germans after a very noble resistance career. And he wanted to marry her very much, and she was wavering in that year and thinking seriously, I think, about marrying Cavaillès. But...
And your evidence for that is she writes you a letter or something?
Well, we spent the Easter of that year together because we joined up, I was revising before schools, and we went down to the south of France on a joint holiday. And it was perfectly clear that she was, I think, thinking about him and at the same time comparing him with Isaiah. Well, it never occurred to me, I think I was probably rather thick about all this, because it never occurred to me, so to speak, that Isaiah was épousable.
I'm not sure it occurred to him. No. At some point.
I don't think it probably did. And then, of course, something happened that summer, I don't know what. But it, and Tips went steadily madder and madder.
You dated from then?
I think she started starving herself about then. No, I don't know when it's... wait a moment. I should have thought she wasn't particularly mad. My father had a breakdown in 35-36. And I would have thought she was still more or less on the rails then. I think this was a period when Cavaillès was descending on her in England from time to time and was ultimately expelled.
Expelled by who, sorry?
Tips.
Yeah.
Who turned him out of... No, I think he jumped out of the car. That you did tell me. He jumped out of the car. He wasn't undramatic in his character, but I think he jumped out of the car in the middle of the Cotswolds and ran away. But... By the time, then let me think, the 36 to 37, I was abroad, first in France and then in Rome. And that was when Tips was starving herself. Started to starve herself. We none of us knew about anorexia then. She had started. She may have started before, for all I know, but she certainly, by the time I was in Paris in the autumn of 36, she was 37. Yes, the Spanish Civil War started in 36, so the autumn of 36. She was certainly beginning to starve herself. And she got more and more bizarre, more and more hostile to all her friends.
Including you?
Including me and including everybody.
When you say bizarre, what kind of things do you mean?
I don't feel sure what... Well, I think mainly relapsing into silence. And... Suddenly feeling that whatever happened, she lived with her mother at Burford, and in a house her mother hadn't the slightest intention of leaving, and suddenly practically forcing her mother to move somewhere else. I mean, that sort of thing. And suddenly having wild plans for this or that. I can't now remember. And having sort of waves of extreme hostility to all her friends, I think.
Did you talk to Isaiah about her?
No.
Has her condition worsened?
No.
Partly because you're aware.
Yes, but I didn't think I would have anyhow, because I was friends of both of them, and I knew there was nothing I could do about their relationship, so to speak, and I kept out of it as much as I could. And so if he's talked freely to you about it, you probably know more than I do.
Well, he's talked freely to me, and then in the correspondence there's some very touching and very passionate letters from her to him. They're very difficult. I mean, as a biographer, it's hard for me to assess how much of this story I need to know or want to know.
No, not very much, I should have thought.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how much effect it had on him, but I would have thought he protected himself from it fairly firmly.
Yes.
Mrs. Indeed. Berlin didn't take to her. I'll tell you a thing about Tips, which is that I think it was about probably in the summer of 44, that sort of thing, before any of us had spotted that how very odd she was capable of becoming. The Elialevis always spent Whitsuntide with us in the lodgings, and Tips had been one of the dinner party. And Madame Alevi had said to Elie afterwards, she told me this, what an extremely intelligent and charming young woman. And Elie had said briskly, dommage qu'elle soit folle. But none of us had spotted that at the time.
Well, you see, it's difficult when you read these letters, which are very touching and which one wants to treat with a great deal of respect. It's simply hard to assess how much is simply what a passionate young girl would say and how much is slightly, as we now say, over the top. There's something almost about the syntax which is a little odd.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. When did she... I think I also need to understand the chronology. When did she publicly, visibly go off her head, and when was she
locked up?
When was she locked up?
It had two stages. The main thing, you see, was that she retreated into absolute silence. And I can't really date this, but I should have thought probably 38. This by 38. Well, then she started eating again. I think she had some sort of physical breakdown and became very fat. And I think it was pretty clear that by that time she was oddish. I went out to see her at Burford from time to time. And then there was some terrible drama that I didn't know about, which I suppose was 38. I must have been 38. When she became violent in some way, though I don't know what way, and was then sectioned, as it would now be called.
By her mother?
Well, I think by her mother, yes. Or anyhow, I think her mother had no choice. I mean, I think she was locked up. Well, and from then on she was always in hospital. And there was a period when she seemed to be getting much better and more like herself, and Phoebe Poole, who was a contemporary of ours at Somerville, and I both went to see her. But she wasn't real anymore. She was less overtly unbalanced, but you didn't feel a real person was there. It was awful. It was absolutely awful. Because here was this brilliant, attractive girl who really opened, educated all her contemporaries more than any of our elders did in Somerville, and she opened our eyes to pictures and books and things that we would never have seen otherwise. And she just, first of all, retreated behind this hostile wall and then stopped existing at all, really. And I suspect this would have happened, Isaiah or no, Isaiah.
Feels very burdened by it, I think, though. I think it's one of the reasons I'm fond of him is he talks about things very openly. But I can tell this is one that still bothers him. I think he thinks like you, it would have happened whatever.
But however much one thinks that, one can't feel it.
Yes, he feels a responsibility, he feels a sadness about it. How long did she live?
I don't know when she died. But quite a while. There was a moment when her mother thought she was going to die of tuberculosis, which she was suddenly discovered to have in hospital. But she didn't. And I don't know the answer.
So you last saw her perhaps in 40 or 38 or 39?
Oh, later than that. It was after the war, I think. Yes, it must have been because I had relations living near, she was in St. Andrew's Hospital, Northampton, and I had relations living not very far away at that time, and I used to go and see, when I say I used, I don't think I did it more than two or three times. I should think in about the early later 40s, after the war, but not long after.
Any other living people who you know who remember her? As you do.
Yes. Sheila Shannon, Sheila Dickinson, whose husband has just died in all the newspapers today, so to speak. Jennifer Hart, but not so well. Sheila, it would be worth perhaps your having a word with Sheila a little later on when she's
yes.
recovered from the sort of immediacy of Patrick's death. Phoebe, of course, is dead.
Of Isaiah in the 30s is he has very intense and extended and developed friendships with women. Your correspondence with him is one of the fullest and most important, and in fact, in the period between 32 and 40, or and well into the war. I suppose your letters. number almost anybody else's, but there's a, he has a wide pattern of female acquaintance and a kind of confessional relations with lots of people.
Yes, I'm sure.
all kinds of people telling him little stories about their lives.
Mm.
And he's behaving slightly like a sort of maiden aunt, a sort of duenna or something. It's
yes.
Very odd.
Yes, there was that element.
But Anne Épousable at the same time.
Well, I would have said so, but not everybody thought so.
Yeah. Who else do you think was attracted to him or very fond of him?
Well, I think Sheila Lind thought that he was in love with her. And I think that Sheila, at one stage, this was really before I knew him, I think. Took him seriously. I suspect it was probably because it was not so perhaps more like an abbé than a maiden aunt. that we all didn't confide in him so freely.
Yeah. I mean, he was also very susceptible to women. I mean, you know, Stephen Spender once said slightly maliciously to him, "Why is it that everybody around you is so good looking?" I mean, he was often. People's looks and their appearance mattered to him.
Yes.
And he was very, when he speaks about a woman, her appearance, her looks are very
important.
Very important to him.
Clearly, yes.
He always thought of you, for example, as exceptionally good looking woman. You know, so, and yet there's this very curious kind of, I don't know, screen between himself and women in this period later.
Yes.
Very puzzling.
Well, do you think it's partly an effect of being an only child?
Mm-hmm. Why do you say that? I think you may be right, but I'm not sure why you're saying it.
Because, I mean, as an only child myself, I think one grows up much more with grown-ups and much less pervious, in a way, to one's contemporaries. And also with a very strong sense of self-protection, because one knows one's the basket in which all the eggs are. I've always thought that very noticeable in Isaiah. More tea?
Did the fact that you were both only children give you... Did you ever discuss that? Did you ever...
No.
I
don't think so. Not that I remember. But we discussed a great many things, and it's possible that we may have.
I suppose that brings us fairly naturally to his parents, and I do want to hear you talk to me about his parents. I'll tell you what I know about his parents. I know what Isaiah says, but I also know what some of the correspondence tells me. That is, there are some memoirs and diaries left behind, on the one hand by Isaiah's father. Very touching sort of family history of the Jewish roots of the family, written in 46. And then a number of notebooks left by Mrs. Berlin, many of them about Isaiah and her feeling to Isaiah. So from that I get a very strong sense of a full intensity. The way in which almost they live their lives through him.
Mm.
So that's what I know, but I don't have a sense of them as individuals.
They were very much individuals. Mm. There was a sort of no-nonsense quality about Mr. Berlin. I mean, one could see him in his gumboots walking about buying forests, so it was all quite in character. And he was sort of brisk. They were the thing about them both, of course, was that they had this marvelous gaiety.
Mm. Right.
Mm.
Mm.
And I found them, they were a sort of lifeline to me in the war, because my mother was sitting in New College, very rather wearily running this sort of superior boarding house for all the people the college had put into the lodgings. Not that she had to feed them, but she had to run the house, and having various girls and things living there. I came in, she was obviously missing my father very much, and I came down for weekends. And Oxford in general in the war was fairly bleak, because not many of one's friends were about. And there were the dear Berlins, using Isaiah's room in New College, always pleased to see one to all appearance, and always bubbling with gaiety. And it was tremendously life-enhancing to drop in on them. And Mrs. Berlin, of course, knew understood absolutely everything.
Really?
Oh, yes. And I'd learned more about what one might call life, with a capital L, from Mrs. Berlin than I have from most people.
Really?
Hmm.
Expand on that.
No, I can't. I have sort of passing observations, things that I would never have spotted myself about people. She was awfully proud of knowing Lettish and having been brought up in the country.
Yeah.
And of being able to wring out a sheet by herself, and had very strong wrists, she used to say.
Yeah.
And she was a flawless housekeeper. The house was in Hollycroft Avenue was hideously ugly, but marvellously well kept and clean.
Isaiah, I think, had fantastic respect for his mother as well as love and everything. She obviously drove him mad. But I always have a sense that he was slightly sorry for his father. But you're creating a rather different impression, a rather more impressive figure in my mind. More.
I think, yes. I think Isaiah probably felt his father didn't keep up with his mother himself, to some extent, or anyhow. And I think he felt that his father was more devoted to his mother than his mother was to his father, which may have been true. But I didn't think of him as pathetic at all. I thought it was a very robust and admirable character.
I'm interested in the note of gaiety, because often the stuff that Mrs. B leaves behind is full of, well, intimate diaries are often more anxious than the public.
Because you work out your
anxieties
in your diaries.
But you feel tremendous vitality, but you don't feel gaiety, you don't feel laughter.
No, but we laughed incessantly. That's one of my main recollections of being with Mrs. Berlin, peals of laughter.
Yes. Did she have an extremely thick accent?
Yes.
But she wrote very, very clear English.
Did she?
You heard a thick.
Oh yes.
Was
and
it a deep voice, a high voice? What kind of voice?
I think just don't think it was particularly either deep or high. It was just an ordinary sort of voice. But very accented, and her turns of phrase were very Russian. And she always tried to make one eat too much. She always produced the most marvellous food, delicacies, you know, and cakes made with walnuts and cream, that sort of thing. And one was always pressed to eat and eat and eat.
Was she a person who ever talked about ideas, or did she have a sort of intellectual side to her?
She had a very religious side. I think she was very, very Jewish, and she didn't talk about ideas, but she went to lectures on when she was in Oxford, and said how interesting to hear subjects dealt with from the Christian angle as well as from the Jewish.
I mean, if you had to stand back from her, and what do you think that Isaiah took from her? I mean, apart from everything. I mean, is there anything that stands out in her character that you see in Isaiah and you feel she got from her?
Well, the bubblingness. Not that I thought Mr. Berlin bubbled a good deal too.
Did you have a sense of their marriage? Did you have a sense of them being close or complicit, or was there a sort of iciness that came in?
I didn't think he said any iciness at all. I don't think I was looking for it. I mean, I wasn't really analysing things. I was just enjoying their company.
Isaiah's always rather scornful about the way his mum dressed and things, how she presented herself. What impression did she make on you as a woman?
I don't think she had any visual taste at all. On the other hand, the paintwork in Hollycroft Avenue was washed once a week. She was a very, very scrupulous housekeeper.
Did she confide in you her worries about Isaiah? Or he would be away in the States?
No.
No. Why do you think you became such good friends?
He and I?
No, she is.
She and I.
Yeah. My phrase.
But perhaps it doesn't mean much.
No. It's a lovely phrase. It made me wonder, to ask you unexpectedly, when both she and Isaiah saw the point of view, what did you think they saw about you?
It never occurred to me to ask the question.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't ask oneself that question when one's in one's early 20s. One expects to be liked.
Yeah. Now, during the war, remind me what you were doing in the war.
I know
the answer to this question, but I've somehow...
A piece of the BBC. First of all, I was in a rather phony organisation called the Joint Broadcasting Committee, which was really a front organisation for getting recorded material into Germany, I think. And then when its founder died, which she did in, I think, 41, or 40 possibly even, I can't remember, we were amalgamated with the transcription service of the BBC, and our job was not to broadcast, to have anything to do with broadcasting in London, but to provide stuff that stations outside England could use in their own services. And I dealt with, I think we wasted a lot of public money. I think we weren't really very useful, but we felt we were at the time. I dealt with the French colonies and Portugal, I mean the Raleigh colonies and Portugal, and looked after a certain amount of stuff about the Free French for Latin America. And then at the end of the war, I went into the Colonial Office.
There's one letter that I found from Isaiah to you, and in your letters you kindly sent me, saying how lonesome he was in New York. This is 40, late 40, early 41, I think.
Yes, I remember when I reread the letter. Yes.
Yeah, wishing you could come out and get a job in New York. And the obviously had a very tough time at the start of his American.
Why did he?
Well, I think it was at a period then when he was waiting for this, the Guy Burgess trip to Moscow stuff to happen, and it didn't, and he was very much at a loose end.
And really expecting to go to Russia.
I think so, yeah. I think that's what, partly what got him out. And much more anti-American than I'd expected. I mean, so much of his...
Really?
Yes, it's, I find your letters are terribly... his letters to you are very interesting on that subject, and other letters confirm it, that his initial impression of America is terribly negative, and it comes later that he gets terribly Rooseveltian and Deal and
Yes.
loves the energy and drive. But that's when he's got into the Washington world.
Got into the swim.
His initial reaction is, get me out of here. I can't. I don't like the Americans. I don't like it. I want to be back in Europe. I want to be back in Britain. And that's rather... makes his reaction to America more complicated. Let me look at my notes, because I don't follow the chronological pattern. I get a sense that you saw a lot less of him after the war.
Yes.
And why do you think that was?
Well, I think we'd both got other circles by then.
Put it sort of brutally, did you ever get the feeling that Isaiah had dropped you? I have no reason to suppose he did, I'm just asking.
No, I don't. I think that, I think we saw each other a great deal before the war because we lived on each other's doorsteps. I mean, one met all the time.
Yes.
And after the war we didn't.
You were in London in the colonial office.
Yes. But I never for a moment felt that he wouldn't help if I wanted help or something
yes.
of that sort.
Yeah. There was no cooling. There
no,
was
no.
Just
no. It was just as we were swept in different directions.
Yeah. When did you get married?
Almost, oddly enough, the same time that Isaiah did, in 55. No, not for 10 years.
Yes. The wonderful letter from Isaiah to you in the '70s, in 74, saying it's one of the best letters of self-description he ever wrote to anybody, which is a sign of his closeness to you. He said, I think with embarrassment of my life as a series of train passenger carriages connected by couplings across which very few people actually manage to cross. That is, you know, there's one compartment for the 30s and then there's one for the war and then for the 40s
yes.
and 50s, and very few people cross. And I had a feeling he was saying that to you as if to explain why it was that you...
That we didn't see,
we didn't
see each other much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very possibly.
Yeah.
Mm.
I thought it was revealing.
Yes, I think it's probably true of him a good deal more than it's true of me, in fact. Because I also have led a life in series of quite different slices.
Yes.
But I did, I think, probably keep connections going over the couplings more than
he did. Yes. Do you reproach him for that?
No, not in the least. Certainly not.
Can we go back to the 30s a bit? Because I'm still... I think I need some help with the Lind.
Well, I'm at your service over the Lynn sisters.
I mean, mean, I need to know about their background and their origins and their father, and then how they come into Oxford, how it works.
Well, Robert Lind was a very engaging Irish journalist, good-looking, gentle, slightly drunken, but no more than reasonably so, I think. Married to an extremely dynamic, good-looking, ambitious wife, who she was Miss Dryhurst, and very much in a sort of Hampstead left-wing revolutionary tradition. And they had these two dazzlingly beautiful daughters, one exactly like her mother to look at, and one exactly like her father. And Sheila was talkative, amusing, laughing, fair, and BJ at that stage was drooping and silent. You know what she looked like, do you, BJ?
No.
I can show you that at once because I see
And why was she called BJ? She was more.
I'm ashamed, I'm embarrassed to tell you that it stands for Baby Junior, because she and her sister were very close together. And so everybody who knew them as a family. That's exactly like BJ at that age. Very romantic Irish. Well, BJ, Sheila, I'm sorry to say, was jilted by a cousin of mine called Jerry Young, to whom she became engaged when she was an undergraduate, and he was too. I think they, one of my maternal aunts was a friend of the Lynns, and my aunt Olive Heseltine, and she, Sylvia Lind was often ill, their mother, and Olive used to take the Lind girls off on holidays, and therefore they were very much absorbed into the cousinage on my mother's side. And Jerry and Sheila, as I say, were engaged, and Jerry then extricated himself. And I think Sheila took it rather hard, and at that stage, I think, threw herself into the Communist Party, though with an interval of my eye, perhaps in between. I can't do the dating of that. And BJ also had a muddled life from the point of view of men, because she became engaged to Tommy Hodgkin, who ultimately married Dorothy Hodgkin, and she jilted him idiotically because she lost her heart to a rugger blue, who I don't think ever looked at her twice, as far as I know, but she was, there were moments when with my contemporaries I felt like an Eleanor among rows of Marianne's. And in a very much more romantic way, I think BJ having peeled potatoes for her hunger marchers. Then also went into the Communist Party and became much more dedicated than Sheila, and married a man called Jack Gaster, who was the 13th child of a Romanian rabbi, who was a communist eminence. And she never got out of the party at all, though she lost her faith. I mean, she was very martyred about it, because Jack remained a devout communist, and BJ felt she must stay in the party because of him. So that's the Lynn sisters. But It was very largely, I think, reaction from Sylvia Lynd, who was frightfully ambitious for them. She had these two dazzling daughters, and she wanted them to make... I mean, she wanted them to marry people like David Sissel, so to speak.
And he didn't.
But BJ, who was mine, and Sheila was, I suppose, 3 years older than me, and BJ 1 year older. And they knew everybody, both first Sheila and then BJ knew all the clever young men and all the world of Oxford at that time.
Out of sequence, really, but it's just that it figures so much in the public mythology of Virginia Woolf coming to dine.
Yes.
I wonder whether you could give me your sense of this story, because I have...
There's a piece by Isaiah, isn't there?
Yes, yes. And there's a big crossbow down at one end of the table, booming.
Booming. Well, mainly the visual one of how extraordinarily beautiful I thought Virginia was, sitting with her cheroute and a red velvet dress in the corner of the music room at the drawing room at the lodgings. I don't remember. I think Isaiah over, well, as one would expect, writes up the embarrassment and difficulties of the conversation.
Didn't seem so agonizingly self-conscious to you.
Not to me. Mm. But then my antennae are much less long than I last.
It's typically it doesn't have a red velvet dress. And gotta have the red velvet dress. And the cheroot too. She was staggering. I'd like to go on and on, but I feel as if what I want to do really is to stop and think about some of the things you've told me and whether it'd be possible to come and see you again.
Yes, do.
Because I mean, the fact is that there are a lot of things I don't know yet, there are a lot of things I don't understand. And you're almost the last soul who was there, so.
I
I'm sorry to emphasize
I'm very old.
So I'd like to, if I could, come and talk to you again about some of the things you said about their parents are especially precious to me, because that really is difficult to get a third view on.
Yes. I suppose Jennifer Hart knew Mrs. Berlin. I suppose lots of people must have known Mrs. Berlin.
Yes. Stuart Hampshire did too.
Yes.
So. But let me stop there.
Right.